Reagan, you will now respond to Father Lamont.
Reagan?
Yes?
That time in the room. Try and remember Father Merrin just before he died.
We're alone.
Is his heart strong? Resolved?
He is praying.
Is he in pain?
Yes.
Is he casting out the unclean spirit?
He is praying.
And you, Reagan, what are you doing?
What the hell just happened?
Right?
I now I'm questioning my existence on the planet, everything I've ever seen or done before, my choices in life.
Yeah. What brought us here? How did it come to be? I've seen this film before and I still am left with these questions. I was hoping you'd be able to fill me in on some stuff, but you seem to be in the same condition I am.
I'm perplexed, bewildered, and beguiled. What was that song? Perplexed, bewildered, and beguiled.
It's something similar to that. We don't have the rights for you to sing that on the show.
We are doing The Exorcist 2, The Heretic, this week. Last week, Exorcist. Next week, Exorcist 3. And our run-up to Halloween with a special guest, by the way, next week. Don't miss that episode. Coming off the high that was the first Exorcist, even though it is a difficult film and raises a lot of difficult questions, it was a joy to talk about. I know that sounds contradictory, but it's not. I'd suggest you go back, listen to that episode. And then we get to Exorcist 2, The Heretic, which I realized I had seen scenes of. I stayed away from it. I stayed away from all the other Exorcists, as I said last week. And right now I'm starting to think I made a pretty good decision.
Oh, no, don't say that. Okay. Can I ask you, were you not entertained?
Oh, my God. Well, here's the only reason I was entertained. It might have been the most fun movie I've ever seen because, again, as now has happened, you've seeped into me like Pazuzu, like you are in me, Tony Arkin.
No, no.
That's right. Please. I'm saving that drop. Oh,
we had so much potential in the marketplace until just now.
So as I watch a locust fly me through the world with his little wings, all I could think of in that moment was Tony Arkin in maybe a certain state of consciousness watching this film whenever you watched it. And I just could not stop belly laughing through the whole thing. Every time they got to a flying locust, like POV shot, I was just crying laughing because I was thinking of you. Normally, I would have just shut it off and gone to bed.
Mm-hmm.
But in fact, you are the heretic. You are the heretic because I see the movie through your eyes. You're Kazuzu or whatever.
Kazuzu's great. Billy Bob Briggs, you would called it Isuzu on his show.
Is that true?
Mm-hmm.
Oh,
he wouldn't say it. I think he was too freaked out to even say it, unlike you or me. But yeah, I don't know. I mean, okay. We should give context. It's going to get really confusing. And yeah. I think we've started off a little confusing, confused ourselves. Let's bring it in here. What are we talking about?
We got to rein it in. This is actually perfect for the film because this is the bizarre and inexplicable nature of the film. This opening very closely parallels what this thing is because you spend your time watching this going, what? Huh?
Yeah. Who? And how did we get here?
Right.
How did we get here from what I was just saw?
The first Exorcist, one.
The one with the exorcisms and the priests. I saw that movie and now we're going to do part two and it's this.
It's stunning. In fact, it's quite an achievement that you could have what some critics believe to be what many people believe to be, if not the greatest horror movie ever made, the greatest film ever made. And then have what many believe to be the worst film ever made when you look at the budget and the people in it and what was expected of it. So, wow.
That being said, I just want to say there are people that think Dirty Dancing is the best movie ever made. So we have to take all of this with a grain of salt.
Let me tell you something. If you besmirch the Sways on this show,
I didn't.
You're going to
I wouldn't. Okay. I would never do that.
Okay.
Just making a, I'm just making a reference. It's, you know, it's an as if.
Nobody puts baby in a corner.
Let's move on. Let's move along.
And nobody, imagine if we just talked about Dirty Dancing instead.
No, no, no. We're sticking to our guns. We're sticking right here.
First, let's do this. If you'd like to reach out to us, we are at Rated Paranormal on all your social media. You can also go to our homepage, anchor.fm/RatedParanormal. Send us a message or leave us a voice message. Let us know what you think of The Exorcist. Let us know what you think of The Exorcist 2 after this review. Maybe we're way off base. Maybe you think this is a classic. Maybe you love it. Maybe you do think it's an artistic vision that we don't get. We would love to hear from you if that's the case.
Well, you don't really know how I feel about it yet, though, do you?
I don't. I'm assuming. I'm making assumptions I shouldn't make. We got a lot of comments, a lot of buzz about our Exorcist episode. Dana says, great episode. This is Dana Sanderson. I had no idea Reagan was leaving the house through the windows. I'm completely freaked out now. I snuck in the theater with older kids to see this movie when I was 11 years old. It took 20 years to get over my fear of the movie. Now, knowing about the window thing, shudders. With a D.
Yeah, that's a nice little double entendre.
Yeah.
Boy, you know, I've been thinking about that since we discussed it, and I'm literally get chills walking down the street now just thinking of that happening at night. Terrifying. Thanks for that email. No, I'm glad that other people are frightened.
Carrie Taylor, superfan, said, so I saw parts of this when I was a little kid, scared the crap out of me after listening to the episode. I appreciate the movie and the story surrounding it. Enjoyed the review as usual. Thought about giving the movie a second chance and tried to watch The Exorcist, but nope, still can't do it. There's just something about this movie I can't do. I feel you, Carrie. I don't think I would have watched it again if it wasn't for this podcast. Kevin Dignam says, you're doing Exorcist 1, 2, and 3, and we are. This is 2. 3 will be next week with a special guest, as I said. I'll have to watch 2 before the review. I really enjoyed 3 a lot when I saw it. And we have a little announcement to make.
Time for the Rated P for Paranormal big announcement.
You and I have both seen The New Halloween by David Gordon Green.
That is correct.
And we are going to give you people, because it's Halloween time, a little extra Halloween treat. We're going to do a bonus episode where we're going to review the new Halloween film. And we will drop that probably in the next few days. So look for that. But I saw a little movie news about that, Tony, that David Gordon Green, apparently, and this ties in perfectly with everything that we're doing right now, is going to direct all 3 movies in a new Exorcist trilogy.
Really?
Yes. So after
you want to tell, you want to do this like live with me responding to that without any ability to prepare.
I'll tell you a little bit about it and you form your opinion and let us have it. After completing work on Halloween Ends, David Gordon Green move on to the Blumhouse produced Exorcist trilogy. And he's now planning on directing all 3 himself. I guess the plan is he was speaking to Collider about different projects. And he said, yeah, that's the idea right now. He went on to reveal that the first one of our trilogy, meaning Exorcist, is written and the second 2 are being outlined. It's a new journey with some familiar characters and some new ones as well. So it looks like that team, Gordon Green and probably Danny McBride, who worked on this Halloween trilogy, are going to now do an Exorcist trilogy. Thoughts?
I think this is more of the problem. I mean, I don't have a problem with David Gordon Green or Danny McBride at all. And there's a lot to be said for, you know, for at least them being involved in these rehashes. But to me, that's what these are. I really just feel like original material is what makes these movies worth remaking in the first place. So curb some of that remaking and just make something similar. It's okay if it's similar. I mean, what's brand new now anyway? Like, just try to get me into the theater, not using somebody else's work to lure me in. I mean, I think that's utterly unnecessary to begin with. I don't think this film really needed any sequels, really, at all. I don't need to see remakes of The Exorcist, personally. How about you?
Time for a Matty rant. Here is the problem that's going on right now, and it seriously makes me so mad. I want to say this to the people that have made this decision. Oh, wait a second. Hold on. It says here they're currently in casting for potential priests. I think it's a great idea. I'm all for it.
Well, we are in that awkward position. I mean, I want to be honest, and I know you do too. And I also want to work, and I want to be respectful of people, particularly like peers who are working in the, not peers, but like, I mean, you know, as if Danny McBride's a peer. I wish.
I would say this, you know, I root for them. I love Danny McBride and Eastbound and Down, everything they did together, all the stuff. I root for them, but I would say I would much rather see whatever it is they've got in their minds than to see them rehash something else that it already existed. That's all. That's all it is. I want to see more Eastbound and Down, make a horror version of that. I don't know. You guys are the genius creative Hollywood guys, to see another, as you said so brilliantly, we were talking about doing this bonus Halloween review, which we're going to do. You said something to the effect of like, what, why is everyone trying to explain this character to me of Mike Myers? Like, why stop trying to explain Michael Myers to me? And I'm like, yeah, I know.
Yeah. I mean, it's weird because there's a lot of similarities between these two remakes that we'll talk about.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. So, and I was thinking about sequels, and this is not paranormal related, but before we begin with the movie, I thought it'd be a fun exercise. Since this is many consider the worst movie of all time, if not the worst sequel of all time, what's your favorite sequel of all time? Your favorite two movie, your second movie?
Empire Strikes Back.
Huh.
I mean, I think without a hesitation, because I mean, I'm not generally a sequel person.
Yeah.
You know, I the occasional like Lethal Weapon 2, I definitely love and appreciate, but I'm not, you know, I mean, my knee-jerk reaction is Empire Strikes Back, just because it was certainly one of the biggest movies in my life growing up and changed my life, you know, so not a lot of sequels do that. I'm not as big a fan of Aliens as I am of Alien, if that says anything, you know, like I kind of prefer the first versions of things. And then sometimes it just seems like a weaker, like a watered down version of it or something.
Yes.
How about you?
Oh,
Karate Kid. I know Karate Kid we can agree on.
Oh, when he goes to Okinawa, it's so good. I think it's easy, hands down, for me, Rocky II. I think Rocky II is truly a great sequel. I think everything we think about Rocky, you know, if you strip away all the later Rockies and all the crazy stuff Stallone did, right? You look at the first Rocky, this poem, this 90-page script that shocked the world. It's about an underdog, and the movie itself was an underdog. This classic American film. He had so much pressure on him for Rocky II. He had won the Academy Award, you know, for that movie.
Oh, yeah.
And it just was this huge monster that was made for nothing. And Rocky II hits every single box. It takes those characters in a deeper exploration of the characters, which sounds silly in a boxing movie, but it really does. It's got the greatest sports scene in any movie in history. I don't care. Hoosiers, whatever. It's the win scene with Adrian and Rocky when she goes, there's one thing I want you to do for me. What was that? Come closer. What? Win. Dong. Win. Dong. What are you waiting for? Take this. I mean, like, I get the chills just thinking about that scene.
Yeah.
And they follow Apollo Creed home, and you see him breaking down with his wife. I mean, it's kind of sprawling, and it's kind of awesome. And we always quote, yo, Adrian, I did it. That's not Rocky I, that's Rocky II. You know what I mean? So I think with what was expected of him and how he delivered, now 3 gets a little campy, 4 gets ridiculous, 5 and the rest is silly. But if you just take those two movies, I mean, I think that's the best sequel of all time.
Not going to argue with you on that really at all. I mean, again, like I don't have a huge stake in sequels, I guess, in general, but I think that's a terrific movie. And I really do think of them as two like parts of the same whole. Those two movies feel like one movie to me.
Yes.
Bit. I remember like feeling like they just felt like Godfather 1 and 2. Like those really aren't two movies to me. Everybody talks about which do you like better. I'm like, if you're not sitting down to watch Godfather 1 and 2,
maybe
making a mistake.
That's
a
good point. He had to. It's funny though, a lot of pressure on that one and had to deliver, and he did. And like he had to kind of have Rocky win in a way because he doesn't win in one. Everyone forgets that.
Yeah, he doesn't.
And yet he pulls it off in a way that is so, you're so invested by the time that fight happens because of the character work. You know, the father Carmine scene, like little touches like this, like, oh, I could do a whole podcast about Stallone.
Yeah, well, maybe we should. Maybe we should try to do that. We can record The Exorcist too some other time.
Like he stops on the way to the fight and gets a blessing from Father Carmine. Remember that scene? Yo, Father Carmine, yo, Father.
Yeah.
I mean, that is like that's like on the waterfront. Like it's just so good, you know? And like, so by the time he gets in that fight, you're just rooting for him so badly. And actually kind of, he sets you up to actually kind of root for Creed too, which is
that's the thing. I feel like my big takeaway from that movie, the thing I remember most was being so, as a kid, so conditioned to go to a movie where the person the hero was fighting had to be a bad person.
Yes.
Like as a little kid, that's what we were told in movies a lot, you know, and that beating them didn't just make you cool, but it also was like, you know, somehow vanquishing evil or something.
Right.
Apollo Creed is a great guy. Like he is.
Yes.
I remember really getting to know him in the second one and caring about his problems. And so by the end of it, their kinship, their friendship almost was what it was about as much as anything, which was really, really cool to see in a big popular sports movie. Like usually it's, I mean, you know, I'm thinking of like movies like Karate Kid, where it's like the bad guys in Karate Kid were just awful and you just wanted him to pound them and that was it.
Yes. It's so obvious who's the bad guys and who's the good guys. Yeah.
But it respects the sport, I guess, to say, you know, to make both of these people heroes, you know, and I don't know. I love that about it.
This is the last thing I'll say. We'll move on to the paranormal movie talk, but there's a really smart scene that I always think about when I think about Rocky II. And it's this actor actually named Tony Burton, who's my hosting agent's name, that, you know, Tony Burton. Also.
I do know Tony Burton. I went to high school with Tony Burton.
Yes, you did. But the actor, Tony Burton, the late actor, unfortunately, Tony Burton, who plays Duke, he's Apollo's trainer. And there's this unbelievable scene in the build up to, are they going to fight again? They're going to have the rematch. Duke, his manager, goes up to him and he pulls him aside so no one else can hear it in the office. And he goes, "You hurt that man like I've never seen no man get hurt before. And he kept coming at you. We don't need this man in our life, baby." And Creed just looks at him and goes, "All right, the fight's on." You know, and I'm just like, to put that in there, in addition, like, I think a lot of writers are just like, "All right, the fight's on. And how big can we make it?" He put these little personal touches of his trainer saying, like, "Don't do this. This guy's gonna hurt."
Or they'd go through great lengths to make, you know, Apollo Creed's team into like a bunch of baddies or like gangsters or something.
Yes.
Where, you know, maybe Apollo was okay, but he was surrounded by all these manipulators. And it wasn't like that. He was just, there was a group of people trying to do their job and another group of people trying to do their job.
Yes. Really cool. By the time they fight, you're kind of conflicted. Like, oh God, I kind of want Apollo to keep his title. I feel bad for him, you know, which is
sports amazing. Movie talk, sports all movie right. talk with Maddie.
But if only Exorcist 2 had had the depth writing touch that a Stallone movie had at that time, which is weird to say.
Oh, what are we going to do?
Well, what we're going to do is we're going to talk about The Exorcist 2, The Heretic, and we're going to do it right now.
I've flown this group before.
When was that?
It was on the wings of a demon.
Did he take you to Jeopardy?
Yes, he did.
Owing to his experience with exorcism, Father Lamont, Richard Burton, is chosen by his superiors to investigate the death of Father Marin, Max von Sydow, who died during the exorcism of young Regan McNeil that we saw in The Exorcist. Lamont finds Regan under the psychiatric care of Dr. Tuscan, played by Louise Fletcher. By hypnotizing the girl, he is able to learn that Marin previously exorcised the same demon from a boy in Africa. Hoping for answers, Lamont travels to Africa in search of the youth. I read that off Rotten Tomatoes and literally just learned more than I got in the 2 hours of watching Exorcist II, The Heretic, which was made by John Borman in the year 1970. Who cares? So, Tony, The Exorcist II, let's go.
I should say something now. I need to say something.
Okay.
Oh, God. Oh, my God. I don't know why I love movies like this. I know there's something wrong with me to love them and want to go to bat for them. Mm-hmm. While I know at the same time, there's really nothing redeemable happening here, except that at like a technical level, there are things that I love about how movies are made. And, you know, John Borman, who directed this, is a master filmmaker. I mean, he has made other movies that are considered masterpieces. They're great mm-hmm. movies. Point Blank and Deliverance, you know, are just to name just two that are taught in film schools and pored over by, you know, art film critics. And he also made the rather crazy Excalibur after this movie. So you can see a lot of John Borman in this, even though if you saw The Deliverance and then you saw this, you know, you'd be very confused. Like you wouldn't understand how this same filmmaker could do it. But I love watching even stuff that doesn't work when people were swinging for something really hard and they were swinging really hard. But I just think that mescaline is a really messed up drug.
It's funny you mentioned drugs. I was thinking like, okay, like this is 77. What is amazing? It's like, where was cocaine at this point? Yeah, because this movie is like cocaine and like Epcot Center had a baby. And it's like, because the sets reminded me of like when Epcot Center was first built.
Yeah.
Like, here is Africa. Here, like yeah. Everything's a set.
Yes. Yeah.
And everything looks fake and phony. Like, even when they go back to Georgetown to the stairs, it's all a set. There's nothing about this movie that is authentic or grounded. Although I do have some things about it that I did like, which we'll get to too. But yeah, it's funny. I think that's the only thing you could probably point to is drugs or.
Well, I mean, yes, cocaine was probably, you know, like table salt at lunch, I'm sure, but. I'm really getting a heavy Castaneda vibe. Like I'm getting the idea that, that the makers of this, the writer John Borman, who's, you know, who's in a really like interesting mindset about mythology and stuff. His movies are very mythological and he gets really deep into, you know, the themes. And I'm sure that this movie is heavily researched and really deeply thought about by him, which is the big irony. 'Cause you don't see it. And then when you see it, you don't believe it's real, even when it is. Like there's a very famous hypnosis sequence in the movie that is actually really kind of great standalone.
Yes. Yes. So much potential with that.
And then it's right next to a scene of a man trying to put out a fire with a pair of crutches.
As you do. Who doesn't?
And you're like, okay, it's kind of like going from The Exorcist 1 to this movie is this scene and then that scene. I literally have never seen a worse put together, thought through, acted, special affected scene than that scene. Richard Burton runs into a basement and finds a box of children's toys that's smoking, not even really blazing yet. And Louise Fletcher, who plays the doctor who works in the building, runs to get a fire extinguisher, which takes her a while. And in the meantime, Richard Burton decides to put the fire out with a pair of crutches that he finds in the corner.
Slamming it with crutches, wooden crutches,
and
I might add.
He spreads the fire throughout the entire basement and then catches everything on fire as if that was the intention. And I don't think they knew that that's what was happening.
And even more inexplicably than that, he's compelled to go look for this fire because Reagan drew a picture of him in the center that she's in under the care of this doctor with like three flames coming off his head. And that, and he looks at the picture and says, the flames, the fires, we must put out the fires that are clearly here. And he knows all this because of the picture, I guess.
That's what he put, he deduces it that way.
Because, yeah, so then they cut to a shot of him standing looking at, you know, Louise Fletcher with those three exact flames behind his head as, oh my gosh, that was what was in the drawing, which means nothing.
It means nothing.
It all means nothing.
And also the close-up of that flaming thing is nothing to do with the next wide shot that they cut to where that's a completely different setup. It's, you know, there are scenes where you'll watch some of the most amazing photography. And even if it is a set or a model or something, like some of the most extraordinary, like brilliant cinematography and special effects, like miniature work, kind of like that looks a little bit like, you know, Time Bandits or something, like really beautiful stuff. And then, and you're like, this is the guy that shot Rosemary's Baby.
Right.
The director of photography who shot that and dozens of other like masterpieces. And you're like, oh, this section looks great. And then you get to something where you'll see an actor trip over the dolly track during a shot and they just keep running.
Yes.
They don't do a take two on that. You can clearly see this elderly actor playing a Monsignor at the Vatican. And he walks around his desk for some reason because they just needed to reblock it. It was boring. So they have him walk around his desk where the dolly track clearly would be because it's this circular dolly move. And you see him trip over this and almost fall over. And they just kept the scene going.
It's so... That's where we first meet Richard Burton in with the priest, and the priest is sending the cardinal is sending him on this mission to investigate what happened to the Max von Sydow character. And then we meet Reagan, who is under the care of the psychologist, Dr. Louise Fletcher, and in her center. I want to talk about the Center for Youth.
Yes.
She runs. It's I'm not sure they knew what they were going for. I think what they were going for is kids with maybe special abilities and maybe special needs and deaf children and artistic children and autistic. It just,
yeah, it was like, what it was a, I don't, maybe that was reflective of how little anybody knew about this stuff at the time. And that maybe clinics did, you know, treat all kinds of patients, kinds. But it is weird. Like every kid you meet has a very, very different situation. And
right.
You don't know why they'd be at this clinic together.
The problem is you get the sense with how this movie is constructed and made is that someone just put in the script like, oh, she helps children. And then so somebody went like, okay, well then there's children with issues. What issues? I don't know. Just put them in there. Maybe some deaf ones and some, it's just seems, and then there's
yeah.
I don't mean there are scenes of it happens like five times. There's scenes that are going on in the foreground between Reagan and Richard Burton and Louise Fletcher. And in the background, these children are just pushing this huge hexagon padded thing, and it accomplishes nothing. It's not any sort of physical therapy that has ever been done to any person, child or not, and it just makes no sense. And they keep cutting to it. And it comes off unintentionally hilarious because they're having this like really passionate scene. And then this kid just comes pushing the thing.
The background is so busy. It just keeps on looking like they're ruining this master shot with these actors trying to act. And behind them is all kinds of craziness, like them pushing nurses and like fighting and, you know, but with that hexagon thing, this is a perfect example, though. Oh. And I still feel like we haven't set this up properly. And I'm going to go back and I just want
to. It's an impossible movie to do that with.
But for instance, this to me, I would guarantee you that hexagon shape has some religious connotation to John Borman, like that image of these kids pushing that thing is on purpose. You know, because that's the kind of filmmaker he was. I don't think he'd have something big happening in his frame that he hadn't thought of. But the question is, what are you thinking?
To what end? It never pays off. It's never addressed. I get the sense. I think he is that type of filmmaker and was, but I think on this movie, for whatever reason, they're just that happened. That was laying there in the building that they were in. And he's like, have them push that in the background for busyness. Like that's it's the level. Of detail.
It's certainly possible. I mean, there's no way to really figure it out. I've seen this a couple times and the first time I saw it, I have to admit, I was almost so amazed that I was like, this is the best Exorcist movie just because it's just so crazy. This movie is insane.
It's
completely unhinged and insane.
That's why we're doing such a bad job. I can't get my mind around where to go and how to describe it.
You know, I mean, we start with something that's similar to the first one. Okay. It starts with the Richard Burton character, Father Lamont. He is in somewhere in South America, you get the feeling, involved in not really doing an exorcism, but kind of like around for some kind of exorcism that the locals are performing on this woman, on this young woman, who is seems a little bit older than Regan was in the first one, but she's flipped out and she starts kind of acting like a demon and eventually gets lit on fire. And it's actually a pretty intense beginning. Not the worst beginning, not great, but I was like, okay, well, the image of her like bursting into flames was actually kind of unsettling. And I was like,
yes,
well, all right. Not realistic really, but kind of freaky.
It makes a terrible cut and the special effect is terrible, but I agree with you. It's an effective way to open a movie. Like
goes
in to do an exorcism and she lights herself on fire on purpose.
Yeah. And there's a lot of screaming and yelling and they're in this kind of like Adobe hut with a lot of smoke and flames and it's really intense.
Mm-hmm.
And this is preceded by the title sequence where we're flying, you know, in this locust, what we learn is a locust POV over these mountains and the Ennio Morricone music, Ennio Morricone, like the great composer of all the spaghetti westerns and all like Tarantino's favorite guy and just the genius. He starts blaring stuff at you that you're like, what is happening right now?
I think he hooked up with Yoko Ono.
it's the craziest he's ever been. Like, it's absolutely insane.
Mm-hmm.
And then they cut to this. And then, you know, you're in trouble because the minute that this woman lights herself on fire, they cut to tap dancing.
Yep.
Linda Blair. Tap dancing in sequins and a top hat.
Who looks adorable, by the way. Yeah. She looks fantastic. We haven't seen her since the original Exorcism. She looks fantastic.
And she could kind of tap dance. That's not the problem. The problem is that you're kind of going like, why is Regan tap dancing now?
Little jarring.
What's happening? Little strange.
Mm-hmm.
Why is it? What's the song? I think is, if I'm not mistaken, Lullaby of Broadway.
Yes, yes.
Right. Mm-hmm. I have theories about this, Maddie. And we'll get into it, and I'll prove to you this is all on purpose and there for a reason.
All right.
But what the ever living f- going on? This is The Exorcist. Okay, twice as much Exorcist you think you're going to get.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's funny that scene is a great example of like it. There's nothing to it other than she's tap dancing. So cutting from that girl lighting herself on fire to Regan tap dancing could be a very effective, jarring way to tell this story. But that's literally it all. You see her tap dance, smile, and then you're on to the next scene. And it's never addressed again until you see the show she's doing. And you have to make, okay, I guess she was rehearsing for a show and this is the show.
Yeah. And then a lot of people go dress up fancy to go to a tap dancing exhibit from kids in high school. I don't, yeah, well, in Manhattan, like high society tap dancing.
I'll crush into like a small little stage. You don't go to those?
Is that what John Borman thinks we do in America?
Yeah. There's a lot of that. We've talked about that before. Like directors who don't quite know what you're supposed to do in different places.
To set it up further, she's living in New York alone with her nanny, with her babysitter from the first Exorcist.
Right.
Her mother didn't sign on to do part two and said no thank you, just the way that William Friedkin and William Blatty said, and so is not there, but her character is apparently away on location shooting a movie, and so Regan and the, and her familiar babysitter are living in a penthouse apartment in Midtown Manhattan, and she's going to school, learning how to be a painter, being a tap dancer like you do when you live in New York, and also going to therapy with Louise Fletcher, who runs a children's special needs / psychic research facility.
Yes.
But Linda Blair doesn't remember she was possessed. She doesn't, she's heard that she was, but she doesn't remember any of it.
But then she says she does at various other times.
Oh, she's a liar. So what are you going to say?
Yes. Richard Burton, the priest, shows up into this investigating the death of Mansito's character. He gets involved at the center. And the doctor, Louise Fletcher, has this device where you can wear it on your head, get in each other's dream states, and you know, communicate to each other through this synchronizer, I believe it's called.
Yeah, it's called a dual hypnotizer. And it, believe it or not, that was real, apparently a real technology. I don't know if that prop was real, but they based it on a real thing.
Well, when she's done with it, she just, it was this multi-million dollar piece of technology she used to help children, and she would just throw it in her top desk drawer when she was done with it.
Where it goes. Yeah, you don't lock that up. No. Just toss it in there.
She literally just tossed it in there.
Oh my God. That was such a great detail.
Okay. That happens. And then Father Lamont, played by Richard Burton, ends up going to Africa to pursue this lead of Pazuzu, the demon.
Well, yeah, he sees her visions. He goes on the dual hypno ray with Regan and sees her visions, which have something to do with a locust attack, basically, on an African village somewhere. And these swarms of locusts. And he gets this idea that he's going to go and look for this kid he sees in a dream.
And so he ends up on this African adventure and solves a crime along the way of a guy who had fallen for some reason. And then they have this final climactic event at the room in Georgetown where Regan was possessed in one, but it's a set of it. Nothing's real. Nothing looks good. Regan herself, Linda Blair, is there in an image, but she's not in the same makeup because I guess in real life she refused to wear the makeup. So this kind of does like this B version of her in one that's wrestling with Richard Burton. And it all comes this climactic scene. Are you confused? Good, because so are we. But that's the basics. And this thing is trippy. You get POV shots of locusts like more than a dozen times. You get the screaming soundtrack. It's just a mess. It's a mess.
It's really hallucinogenic. It's very like you could see the, you know, people dropping acid and going to this movie on like some big Cinerama dome. It's definitely a movie, you know, helped by some of your favorite flavor of inebriations. It's kind of famous for that. And it's got so many things in it that are laughable next to some like things that you can't believe you're seeing. Why is Richard Burton here? What's happening there?
Man, I'll tell you, he is. It's so funny as like, so one of the only things about the movie that I thought was just kind of stunning is his ability to be such an incredible actor despite these ridiculous circumstances. And when I was reading about this movie, I was enjoying reading other critics talk about it. And the kind of like generally accepted thing was like, well, Burton was drunk the whole time. And I'm like, yeah, maybe, but he's awesome in this. And I know that sounds crazy, but he's Richard Burton. There's never a false moment with him.
It's amazing.
There's false motivations and ridiculous situations that he is put into because it's such a terrible movie. But his line readings, like his dramatic acting, is phenomenal. I'll give you a prime example. There's this ridiculous thing where she first puts. I know you noticed this. She first puts on the synchronizer, the mind reader thing, and she's like doing the whole thing with Linda Blair, the doctor. And it's actually quite an amazing scene. And I thought, if this is the movie, this could be awesome.
It's making great, right? Okay.
Sound.
So you like that? It's a
yeah. And she's going, Regan, do you remember when you were possessed? Yes, or whatever. And I'm going, oh, all right, this is interesting. And then something goes wrong with the doctor. And Richard Burton just goes, like, he's looking at it in wonder and amazement. Like, what is this crazy thing you've got here, doctor? She's like, well, it's a synchronizer, you see? And then, like, literally within 30 seconds, something goes wrong. He goes, give me that. I'm going to go into a dream state and communicate with her. He's like, God.
He's just never done it before.
He suddenly know how to do it.
I know.
But he's this locked in Richard Burton. And he's like, Reagan. I am here now with you, communicating with you, and I must know, do you know? And I'm like, well, okay, but it's not bad acting. It's just freaking ridiculous.
He's not the problem with the movie.
Right, right.
Jean, wake up. What's wrong with Jean?
Her heart, it's fibrillating.
Put that back on, Reagan. You've got to go back. You've got to go back and find her right now.
I know where she is. Help me to find her. Help me to reach her. Liz, put this on.
Although I will say that, you know, he has a lot of action to do, and Burton is not known for his acting like below the neck. Right. He acts with his head only.
Yes, yes.
And I think after that, you really are running the risk of him falling over. It doesn't look like it just constantly looks like he's maneuvering himself into places where he can stand and not throw up.
Yeah.
And then he can act like, then his eyes well up with tears, like he's feeling so much stuff,
right,
which is probably hatred of John Borman most of the time, I think, because there's one shot that happens in this sequence, actually, where I think it's after this moment with the head thing, and he's saying, I see them in the other room.
Yeah.
And there's a wide shot where he just kind of walks into frame and he turns to camera and looks directly into the camera.
Yes.
For like 5 seconds.
Yes. He like delivers a line of dialogue, like to us.
And I am suspicious that he actually had broken character and was staring enraged at John Borman and just delivered the line just that way. And they kept it in the movie. Like that's weird. And the movie's weird because it's got all these misfires and all these bad ideas they're trying to accomplish. And then they're trying to accomplish them with really weird ideas,
right?
With really strange approaches that just don't work and don't fit in with the rest of the movie, but they're really alarming when they happen.
Oh, geez. How did I forget to include this in our synopsis? In case you weren't confused enough, James Earl Jones is a locust man who is actually called Kokokomo. Hey, Tony, we have a new Ibadala, by the way.
Ibadala.
Ibadala.
Oh, we do.
We have a new Ibadala. And here it is.
Take me to Kokomo.
Kokomo. Kokomo.
Kokomo. Kokomo.
Kokomo.
Kokomo.
Kokomo.
Burton can't even pronounce it the same way. It's like it's a different...
Kokomo.
Kokomo?
You know, I honestly, I can't... It's really hard to watch, you know, James Earl Jones, one of the great actors in history... having to wear yet another ridiculous head, like fake headdress of some thing and loincloths and shit. Like, really? He's literally one of the great actors and he keeps on having to do this stuff. It's just, it's not a lot of fun to watch.
No, it's not. But the demon, the demon locust that flies Merrin and that all these locust swarms and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
James Earl Jones like kind of morphs, it alludes to like him morphing into a locust or maybe being a locust. He's wearing the locust stuff.
Well, and he's communing. I think they're trying to say he's both become a doctor who's trying to genetically modify the behavior of locusts so that they don't swarm and kill everything anymore.
Yeah.
But he's also, you know, he was possessed as a child and probably had, the movie suggests that people that are possessed are possessed because they're special, right? Yeah. This is the philosophy, I think, of this movie. And so he was a special kid who had these genius scientific plans and things he could do later in the future. The devil tried to stop him by getting him possessed. And so that's the original Father Merrin thing.
And so Reagan is too. Reagan is special. And he says that to him, like, Reagan is special and she can stop this.
That's my takeaway was that, you know, was that the movie's I think it's the movie's fatal flaw, unfortunately, when you tie it to The Exorcist, is it tries to explain what's going on and what and the mythology behind it, and totally defangs it in the process.
Totally
with this new kind of new age Castaneda vibe that Borman was really into, because he really wanted to, I think, make a, what he said he wanted to do was make a kind of a cleansing of The Exorcist, because I don't think he liked The Exorcist. I think he really, as a person, was offended by it and couldn't turn down the money, so said, I'll do two, but I want to do it where there's something good here. It's too, he didn't want to do a nihilism movie, so okay, fair enough. But this got him involved in a whole kind of like new age interpretation of the demon, which then made it more integrated. Like, the whole point was to integrate the bad demon with the good and to make peace with the locusts who represented the demon, but you have to be one to control them. So these special chosen good locusts, of which Regan is one, are put on Earth to be able to control this the mass hysteria of humanity. That's what I took out from it.
One of the things we said last week that made The Exorcist so scary is the mythology that you're presented with of Pazuzu, what Pazuzu is, the ancientness of it, as I said, probably erroneously. I don't know if that's a word. But yet you only know that. It's a mystery. It's a spirit that's existed for 3,000, maybe more years. And you just know it's there. You have just enough to make it scary and real and big, bigger than you, bigger than even the priest can handle. And this movie then attempts to tell you exactly what that spirit is and explain its backstory, like an origin, like a bad biopic. And it involves locusts and genetic engineering and grasshoppers. And it just like ruins it. It takes all the mystery out of it and just makes it terrible.
I would bet that if this wasn't called The Exorcist 2 and it wasn't the same characters, it was basically a similar story, you know, maybe Linda Blair's not in it, so you're not thinking The Exorcist, that you'd still be like, what the hell's going on here? But you wouldn't really be angry. You wouldn't be so angry at it. It's right. The fact that it says I'm going to be The Exorcist 2 and then systematically, consciously goes completely in the other direction. I understand why fans of that first movie hated this thing and called it the worst movie ever made. You don't even really have to be a fan of the first one to say that, but if it were a standalone, it would be more of like a Zardoz movie, which was the movie that Borman did before this, where you're just like, wow, that's a crazy drug trip movie. Right. It had a lot of fun stuff in it.
Agreed. I read this account, dude, that I was laughing reading. So I was doing some research about this because I was fascinated by this movie. I'm like, what happened? And so much like in one where all hell broke loose in the theaters because people were so affected by the film, hell broke loose in this movie too, but for the exact opposite reason. And there are these tales of these Warner Brothers executives going to the screening and going, so like, funny. Hey, want to grab something to eat before we go? And they literally had to run like the Beatles because they're getting attacked by the audience. People, fans of The Exorcist, were throwing things at them and trying to attack. Like, what did you do to The Exorcist?
What I heard, and this Friedkin actually told this story in an interview, because he was told it by one of the executives. He said, we went to the theater and in the middle of the movie, an audience member stood up and screamed, the people that made this piece of shit are in this theater right now.
And his name was Alan Arkin.
God. Oh, he's so happy he didn't take this job.
Oh, was he approached? I was just pulling that as a joke.
Trying to think. I think he may have been.
I bet he was. Wow.
It was either this or another weird movie like it, where he narrowly escaped being in something like this. But yeah, no, I mean, they all got up and started like looking around, and it was like people were angry. There was an angry, like a pitchfork mob starting, and the executives got up, they left, they ran out of the theater down the street, and they said it was like there were people blocking other streets as they were trying to get out. Bad news. I mean, people went crazy.
Oh my God.
And then they kept on re-editing the movie. So John Borman would see one of these screenings and like people just were laughing their asses off or very angry. And he would like, okay, I guess we need some recuts. And he'd go, they recut it and then screen it again, you know? And apparently like when they stopped laughing at it, he said we're done, but I don't know when that happened because it's plenty funny, man.
Oh, I was crying with the locust shots. You have these, at first the locust shots are POVs from the locust, so you're just doing flyovers. And then they like do reverse shots of locusts facing you, like, but then it devolves almost like an airplane sketch. The later when you see the locust in the movie, it's like a side profile. And it's like a bad, like, you know, Superman in the old 50s show used to fly sideways. Yeah. You could just see him like on a table, like he was just laying on a table, like the locust against a green screen. It's like a side profile of locust. It's like, is this supposed to be, is this a joke? I really want to know at that point. I'm like, are they in on this or not? And obviously not.
They offered this movie to everybody. They offered this movie to Stanley Kubrick. I mean, which is, I mean, obviously he probably didn't even answer the phone. Right. When they called, but right. I mean, that was never going to happen, but they really thought they had something here, you know, and they didn't. They had nothing.
One thing that is clear with me as I watch this movie is like, I'm becoming obsessed with Richard Burton. Like, I want to go back to him because I find him such a tour de force. Like like he's the only thing about this movie that I'm just like, man, it makes it worth watching to me just to watch him. Like I think he's that incredible. You know, he's put in such ridiculous situations. There's a part in this movie when he goes to Africa, the church he's going to in Africa is a stone village, a mountain village, rocks. And you have to climb up to get to this church
twice. Apparently.
Yes.
You get to see the whole thing twice.
Whole thing, and it goes on for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And when they're showing you the history, a man falls to his death. Years and years and years later, Richard Burton goes to this stone church, and he's being toured around by the priest, and they say, oh yes, a man fell here to his death many, many years ago, and all of us here who have been living here for centuries have been looking for his body, but we can't find it. And Richard Burton just peers over the side and just goes like, well, he hit that rock. He's on. Let me show you where he is. I'll show you right now. So this like British priest who's been there for literally 30 seconds shows the locals where the body is.
And the body was never found.
Malou?
They searched all over, everywhere.
He didn't fall there. He bounced on that ledge and fell there. I'll show you.
Which, by the way, he points that he deflected off a rock. And then they like walk to
100 yards away.
It's not even close none of it to where they happen. Were. It's just baffling. Yeah. It's baffling.
And okay, so this is also around the moment where I was like, but wait, it looks like they actually did go to maybe Africa or the Middle East to shoot that section or part of it.
Outdoor section.
So why didn't maybe you do the other stuff there? I mean, this is where I feel like I could understand Friedkin actually being a little personally upset over this movie. Oh. William Friedkin, the director of the original.
Oh,
because, and certainly Blatty, because I don't think this had anything to do with Blatty's conception of what his novel meant or what any of it meant. He's not a particularly new age kind of thinker, Blatty. He's pretty interested in the classic, you know, albeit maybe mystical Catholic kind of dogma.
Right.
But this is not Blatty's style, this movie at all. It's certainly not Friedkin's style. And every single thing, every creative choice that Friedkin made, Borman did the opposite. Like every single one.
Yeah.
To the point where you're almost like, are you actually kind of critiquing him by literally doing the opposite?
Right.
I mean, not to nerd out too much, but Friedkin, who was, you know, a crazy guy and rather he's still, you know, he's got a big ego on him. You know, he talks about Bernard Herrmann, who's arguably the greatest film composer of all time, did all of Hitchcock's great biggest films. And Bernard Herrmann wrote a score for The Exorcist, which back in those days, if Bernard Herrmann wrote you a score, you just took it and put it in your movie no matter what. And Friedkin turned it down. He totally rejected it. He said it was awful. He goes, the whole thing was like started with church organ music and it was huge and, you know, crazy. And he's literally like, is that a church organ? And Bernard Herrmann was like, yeah, that's a church organ. And he's like, no. So they never spoke again. But he rejected that soundtrack. And then this soundtrack, it's like Borman told Ennio Morricone, go back and do what Bernard Herrmann would have done. There's literally church organ music in the score.
Yeah.
Like at the beginning of the movie. And you're, so it starts becoming like almost an attack on, yeah, on the first movie.
Interesting. It's like, you know, Friedkin had a singular vision and was locked in. And I feel like Borman had maybe a literal like hallucinogenic vision and with 60 components to it and just threw it all up against the wall everywhere he could. And it's just this scattered mess, but you're right. There does seem to be an antagonism.
The sense I get from it is that his sensibilities were upset by The Exorcist, and he decided to take on this job almost to right the wrong of this film, to bring, you know, and he saw it. It's almost like he took it upon himself to bring, to be like the light bearer who's going to alter the karma of this movie somehow, and some kind of like new age cinematic shamanic experience that he'd give the audience, that he'd give them release from the awfulness of the first film. And I can't disagree with his feelings about it. I think The Exorcist is a deeply scary, evil thing in a lot of ways. But it's almost, to me, more evil to try to, you know, A, you're going to take money for it. And then B, to change the meaning and DNA of something to your own likes. This isn't about having answers. The whole thing in the original, in the book and in the original film, is about the mystery of faith, the fact that, you know, terrible things can happen to wonderful people and you don't know why, and you have to get through it somehow. That seems to be a much more actually realistic gift to give people to think about than this hokum about, you know, locusts and being the good locust and getting possessed to make peace with the demon somehow, so you could be a demon whisperer. I mean, I get that from a psychological point of view. I even think that there's some of that philosophy and that some of that shamanism or some of that stuff that I find fascinating. And it actually kind of touches on some very paranormal things we talk about. So there is that. But as a film lover, I just find myself kind of insulted by his hubris to think that I need help after seeing The Exorcist.
It needed fixing.
I don't need you to fix me. I don't need you to heal that experience for me. And you actually kind of besmirched the original, what the original was trying to do.
There is nothing in The Exorcist 2 that comes close to the altruism or the sacrificial light of a broken, guilt-ridden, tortured priest in the end sacrificing his own life, saying, come into me. I mean, that's the, in the midst of all that darkness and rage and sorrow that we talked about, that is a message of hope and light and love and sacrifice.
Yeah.
And there's nothing in The Exorcist 2 that even approaches that. Well, I mean, I think I'd like to say a couple of things I like. Again, I said Richard Burton's performance. I think his acting is unbelievable. And the chemistry between him and Linda Blair kind of jumps off the screen in the midst of this ridiculousness. And I actually Googled it, and they did become quite close. She was quite enamored with him. And there's a scene that was cut out of the movie where the possessed Linda Blair seduces him. And she right off the bat said, no, 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 I'm not doing that. And he was like, no, 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 no. And
both of them. Yeah. They both didn't want him.
I think that's just fantastic. And I just liked watching them together on screen. I actually enjoyed that. And by the way, in the museum, there's a scene where he mentioned something and I wrote, oh my God, they just predicted the internet or maybe even social media.
Father, Do priests believe in ESP?
Some do. In fact, a French priest tired of Chardin thought that we'd all come together eventually in some sort of mental telepathy. A kind of world mind in which everybody would share.
When is that supposed to happen?
I don't know.
2021.
yeah, exactly. Clearly.
Totally. Like, that's kind of a neat, like, so there were these flashes of, you know, him referencing that priest, that French priest who believed would have a collective consciousness. Like there was seeds of brilliance in this film.
Yeah, and truth.
Couldn't do it.
And truth, that French priest is a real person. I don't know if you got into that research, but
I did,
you know,
do that all rabbit
of
hole.
The philosophy behind it, as much as you can parse, there is a philosophy here. It's kind of summed up by what Burton just said in that clip. Apparently, comes from a Jesuit priest named Pierre Teilhard du Chardin, who was a scientist and a paleontologist, and who was the model for Father Marin. And originally, William Blatty created Father Marin with this guy in mind. And he also was a philosopher, and I haven't read him, but apparently he had a very kind of mystical Catholic vision of the future and what could happen to humanity. And I think that that's a beautiful idea. And yep. So is the idea of this being a standalone movie. Make a movie about that, but please don't tie it to these beloved cursed figures from this movie that, you know, the beauty of The Exorcist is that it is so despairing. Yes. And to try to give an answer to it is to kind of ridicule it in some way that bothers me. Now, I also have a lot of things I do love about this movie. I mean, I think it's really watchable. It's incredible. There's always something happening. And visually, they're constantly trying to do stuff that just blow your mind. If you're really watching what they're doing, yeah, it's kind of goofy. And sometimes it doesn't look believable. But still, you know, like the terrace in the penthouse apartment overlooking an actual Manhattan. I mean, there's things that are fake in this movie. And then when they go for something real, it's kind of mind blowing. I mean, I don't know how much money they think Chris McNeil made off that protest movie.
She was like Trump.
I guess that was like Norma Rae or something. Yeah, that movie must have been big.
By the way, who builds a terrace like that where there's huge gaps and you can just literally put your toes over the edge and of a skyscraper?
Insane. Who builds a chrome birdhouse? I don't understand. But you know, I do love the crazy over the top design of it. I think the look is bananas, and I dig it. I mean, I don't understand why Louise Fletcher works in a glass beehive, but it's cool to look at, and I'm amazed that they chose to do it, because you never see the camera in one reflection. This movie is full of mirrors and reflections, and they're shooting into windows and stuff all the time. Mm-hmm. It's perfect. You never see the camera. Now, if you know anything about like photography, that kind of blows your mind. So watching the movie from a technical point of view is really fun too. The models are great. It's not a horror movie but it is kind of more paranormal than The Exorcist in a weird way. I don't know that it makes a case for it, but it deals in it very, very vividly. And I like that hypnosis thing.
Well, yeah, it deals with, you know, ESP and mind reading and mind melding and being in someone's dreams and visions. And absolutely paranormal.
And I even like some of the crazier Ennio Morricone moments, and I don't even mind the flying locusts. I think it's crazy. It's just like,
I found the locust scenes completely hilarious and tiresome and too long and too much and too many, and swarm locust shots were just tiresome. And she solves the whole thing, spoiler alert, with a kind of coyote ugly dance, which in one of the funniest final scenes I've ever seen in a film, she defeats it, mirroring what the James Earl Jones character did as a boy, spinning this thing above his head to make drive the locusts away. She kind of does a version of it with her hand and kind of spins.
Kind of a sexier version, but I'm also calling foul because they stole that from Texas Chainsaw Massacre, and that was also better.
Oh yeah, right.
He tried to put a nice spin on that. He tried to cleanse the world of everything. John Borman is going to try to clean your soul away from all the evil detritus that the early 70s left for you,
and left us feeling somehow worse and more dirty.
I'm just grateful he didn't start a cult, because it would have been a doozy.
Mm-hmm. Well, so in the end, Tony, does this get a rated P for paranormal?
All right. Well, number one, hell no. Number two, understand that doesn't always mean that the movie isn't entirely worth seeing if you like this kind of thing. I mean, if you like movies that are just off the rails, how the hell did this happen? This is one of the all-time greats. So it doesn't belong on our shelf, but hell is it a fun watch.
I can tell you this. I would watch a double bill of this and Stir of Echoes with you anytime, any day. Well, this was great fun, Tony. I look forward to three and our special guest, Amelia Campbell Arkin, your wife, who appears in Exorcist 3.
Yeah, she isn't the star of the film as we suggested earlier. As you did suggest, you didn't know.
I knew
you just wanted to say that. Well, you put me in a spot because what am I gonna say? Like, oh, I haven't seen it, I don't know, or like go on the air saying, like, no, she's not the star of the movie. I can't say that. She's the star for me.
I put you in a horrible situation.
Bad spot.
As a person who's only had one or two lines in every film I've ever been in, to me, she is a star of that film.
And to me. Well, she just wanted everybody to not expect, right, you know, George C. Scott, because she's not George C. Scott. Not at all.
Or Richard Burton.
Richard Burton.
I'll tell you where the body is. Look down there.
He's in my tears.
Oh God. What a blast. And I agree. It certainly doesn't get in our shelf. It's certainly not rated P for paranormal, but I think it's almost like a timepiece as a history lesson, as a, even just time capsule to see Richard Burton act and be put in these terrible situations and still somehow come off with great gravitas when he gets his moment. And the camera gets close in his face and he delivers those. He let's be honest, he really just delivers a bunch of non sequiturs that kind of make no sense and don't really move anything forward or explain anything. He just kind of says these lines like, you know, today evil will be defeated and we must move on and get the evil out of Reagan. But when he gets those moments, it's just jaw dropping. I mean, and the fact that he was a drunk at that time and all that makes it to me more impressive. Like, how did he do that?
He's incredible. I mean, you know, he's kind of hammy and amazing. He can, you know, he's hammy because he can take whatever and make something out of it. Like, he likes to act. He loves to use his voice. He loves to fill it with passion. I mean, we just saw for Arkin Brothers show, Spy Who Came In From the Cold.
Oh, what a movie that is.
Which, like, if you don't know about, like, don't, if you don't know Richard Burton, don't start here. Start with that, you know.
Well, you don't like the dashiki shirt he wears after he drops the priest collar?
Thank you so much for bringing it up. My favorite moment in the movie. I laughed my ass off because I was like, there's so many things going on, how do we track all these characters, and he went to Africa but we don't know if he came back and all this stuff, and I'm like, well, how do we know he came back from Africa? And you go ding dong, opens the door, and he's got like a dashiki shirt under his priest suit. I'm like,
it might as well have said, like, you know, if he went to Jamaica, like one of those smiley t-shirts, hey mom, I went to Jamaica, mom,
just in case we didn't know he just got back from Africa. I don't think that John Borman is really a good director of actors. I think he's a great director in a lot of ways, mainly because if you look at somebody like Louise Fletcher, who I think is a wonderful actor,
what happened?
Looks like she doesn't know how to act in this movie. And what that's happened? Really not true. I think she was confused maybe and uncomfortable. But my point to bringing it up is, why does she have heart attacks in all these science fiction movies where she's hooked up to brain machines? What's going on?
That's her
Did
thing.
Her agent not know that she, like, when they took brain scan, was this a reference to Heretic? And then there's another movie, Shadow Zone, and I think it happens in Firestarter. I she keeps on like doing paranormal things and then having heart attacks in movies. It's weird.
You play tattoo artists. I play cops with one or two lines, and she does mind melding.
She's parapsychologists with weak hearts.
And why the heretic? Who's the heretic? The demon?
Again, I could think about it and get back to you. There's so many more things. I mean, I
keep going.
You know, we have to. Well, I mean, my God, the tap dancing comes back again, referencing this. He goes, you know, the second time we go up into the stone church of in the cliff, and there's this giant, you know, celebration or ritual that happens, a lot of dancing and singing. And then they immediately smash cut back to her tap dancing again, this time in the show. And it's Lullaby of Broadway. It is terrible. It's ridiculous.
They're in this like handmade set, like black box theater, and all the kids are kind of crushed together. So they can't really move. So it would be a show that you crowded into this weird small theater with people to watch eight teenagers stand shoulder to shoulder and not really be able to move and tap dance. And
yeah. it's like watching? A Wes Anderson version of all that jazz.
Yes.
And it lays here for a while. Now we're like tapped. Now we're just seeing a show, a tap dancing show, sequins and, you know, very glossy lighting and like, you know, and I figured out this is also John Borman saying that artists are the chosen ones.
Mm.
You've often said things like that, like, you know, maybe the paranormal effects. Well, I think this is John Borman's attempt to say she's an artist. She is a sensitive dancer. And then it ties it into the dance with the thing and the locusts at the end. But tap dancing is where I go, are you making fun of it? Are you, you know, this is ridiculous? Because we don't.
Oh, no.
I mean, I don't do this all the time here. This isn't a thing we do, like all of us do.
Yeah, no, I think he did. It was not intentional at all.
Bigger question then becomes, did David Lynch steal this for the beginning of Mulholland Drive?
It was a tribute.
I mean, it's a jitterbug. I know it's different. Maybe it's tribute. Was it conscious or not? I'd love to hear from some people out there if they could give some info on that.
There are some parallels between him and this movie and Mulholland Drive. There's some really kind of trippy parallels here.
Well, what did you find? What parallels?
Well, no, just the vibe, like the bizarre dreamlike state of, am I watching something real here? Is this a
right?
And the psychic connection thing, and you're not sure what's a dream sometimes and what's not, what's a vision and what's not, what's you know, another thing. Speaking of Mulholland Drive, like kind of the creepy romance things that go on in that movie between the two leads and some other people. There's this weird, bizarre, hinted at attraction between Louise Fletcher, Dr. Tuscan, who's running this bizarre place for children, and our priest star, Richard Burton, Father Lamont. And there's, but of course, nothing's made of it. Nothing happens. They just allude to it. And, you know, she says, don't you need a woman? He said, well, yes, sometimes I do.
That's a great, it's a great moment. It's very strange. And the unexplored moment, they just kind of go, oh, that's awkward. Let's move on.
Exactly.
But he's like, what do you want me to say? I'm not going to lie to you.
And then at the end, after the big climactic, you know, the devil, things break apart and it goes on forever and everyone's just screaming and there's locusts and she does her little twirl dance, Linda Blair, and it's just him with this fake, you know, green screen background behind him and Louise Fletcher, and he just has the dashiki shirt and he just like brings her in for this big embrace and it's like, is that a priest comforting a person or is this their romance? I don't know. I don't want to know.
It's the remake of Brief Encounter from John Borman. Yeah. The car wreck at the end, the spinning around in the taxi cab, poor taxi driver going, what's happening? I mean, it just, you can't really believe any of it's actually going on or that they saw the rushes and went like, yeah, this looks like the real place. This looks like it's really happening.
And these touches of not knowing reality and film, like, for example, in the world of The Exorcist, all that happened was this girl was possessed up in her room and a priest died at the stairs. Right. That's real life. Like, no, it wasn't an Exorcist movie. It was a thing that happened. And when she gets in the cab, she goes, right. You're laughing. So, you know, she's like, we're going to eight. Edmund Place. What's the address? I don't even know the address in The Exorcist. I probably should know. Horror fans know it. But, you know, she's like, we're going to 8 Edmund's Place. He's like, 8 Edmund's Place?
He just has this great look in the rearview mirror. It is clear. It's like, oh.
You're going to the set of The Exorcist? It's basically, like,
yeah.
How would he know that address?
Yeah, it's true.
A thing happened there. Like, there's homicides and murders and deaths.
Like 5 years ago. Like,
yeah, exactly. Like,
you know. I also want to give a shout out to the train conductor. When I saw the train conductor, when one of the travels Richard Burton takes, he's on an Amtrak train where they serve drinks and whatnot, of course. And
I put that in my contract, Tony.
Did you recognize? Oh, that's happening in Contractor. No, apparently. But did you recognize the guy bringing the drink?
Let me think. I forget that scene entirely.
There's no scene. He's an extra. That guy was the mailman and one of the head bad guys in 3 Days of the Condor.
Oh, no kidding.
Why he has no lines and he hands him a drink in this movie, I don't know, except that maybe there was other things cut out that we have yet to hear about. Also, if you like tap dancing, you may also enjoy old American folk tunes for kids, similar to like, oh, E-I-E-I-O. Old MacDonald Had a Farm is also in this movie.
Oh, yes.
Cut to at a time you're not expecting and really feel it's inappropriate. And yet I know why it's there. I know why it's there. It's more of John Borman's healing and misunderstanding of American people.
And it's so insulting. And I didn't even want to go here because it just trends in dangerous areas. But it's just like, oh, we've got these special children who have special needs. So we're going to do a We Are the World chorus. And like, it's just so insulting to the kids. Like,
it's insulting.
Singing E-I-E-I-O.
A strange thing, but I don't think he knows what that is. That song is like, oh, it's a charming American children's song. I think we should play it to do it. And why do we have it? Well, because it's about farming and the earth and renewal. And it's an anti-locust song. I bet you anything he freaking said that.
Yes. And there's a scene between Linda Blair and the late Dana Plato, by the way, another surprise cameo from, Different Strokes. Dana Plato, and Dana Plato plays a girl with autism, she says.
She
stutters. So I'm like, okay, well, does she have a stutter problem or autism or both? Or what are we doing here? And she's healed by Reagan because she speaks to her. Again, super insulting.
Really insulting. But they researched all of these weird mythological Castaneda concepts, but didn't do like a moment's research on autism or what that would be like to have, any of it. But I have to say that scene is responsible for the best line in the movie. Is when she goes, what's wrong with you? And she goes, the little girl, Dana Plato, says, well, I am autistic. And says, I can't speak to people. She's speaking now. I don't know why the healing started pretty early when Linda Blair shows up.
Right.
And the little girl says, what's wrong with you? And Linda Blair goes, oh, I was possessed by a demon. Pause. It's okay. He's gone now.
Yes. Smiling. Like she's all blurry. It's just like a soft lens, like Big Valley. It's like, I was possessed by a demon. He's gone now.
He's gone now.
Tilt the head. Smile. Oh, God.
There's moments of shocking. You just shocked. Wow. They thought it was good. They saw the dailies. They put this in. They didn't think someone was going to laugh.
And how about Ned Beatty as the pilot showing up after deliverance?
I couldn't figure out for a minute. I was like, why the hell? I'm like, oh, he was free. Borman called him up. He's like, look, do you want to step in? You're an Academy Award winner. I need some juice here in this film. And he's the most realistic actor in it, actually.
He's actually really good in that scene. And that was the clip I played, the demon flight. I flew there on the wings of a demon.
Yeah.
Oh, did he take you over there? Yes, indeed he did. And I've got an obscure Maddie fact tying into your dad. You ready for this? I'm going to make a crazy pull here. That scene was reminiscent of one of your dad's movies, a great understated performance in the movie So I Married an Axe Murderer, which your dad was awesome in as a police captain. There's a scene where they take a flight. Mike Myers' partner takes a flight to go rescue him. And I believe the pilot is Stephen Wright, the comedian from Massachusetts, who does an incredible job as the pilot. That scene actually reminded me of that scene. It had about the same level of special effects of the flight.
Which was pretty hot. It's pretty, very good stuff.
Equally comedic, although in the case of I Married an Axe Murderer, intentionally comedic. I think this one was unintentionally comedic. And that's my favorite line, by the way, in the film, is Richard Burton saying, I flew there on the wings of a demon. Did he take you to there? Yes, he did.
My favorite thing is, I think, Richard Burton falling into the pit of nails. I just love that. Ooh,
that's a great little body horror moment, actually, when his foot goes through the nail and then he wakes up in the locust farm.
Pretty good. It was very, very, very giallo, very Dario Argento moment. And I would also like to suggest that Ennio Morricone, the great Ennio Morricone, kudos to you for jumping into a room with that band Goblin, who did all those Argento movies, and doing acid with them. That clearly influenced you.
That takes some
guts. This is a score written after listening to Goblin and doing acid, and God bless him, he did it.
I mean, whoever the vocalist was, I'll make no something.
I think that was Ennio Morricone.
I'm telling you, it's like literally just a person shrieking and screaming at different times. And it is actually quite, but see, here's the thing. It's not disturbing. It's annoying. It's more fingernails on the chalkboard than it is mysterious and disturbing. It's annoying and grating. It's grating, I would say.
It's grating and probably purposefully so.
I feel like they're going crazy for spooky, and I think they're going for spooky and alluring and foreign sounding, and it just sounds,
I don't know. Morricone might have hated this and been like, I'll give you a score. Oh yeah, I'm friends with Bernard Herrmann. I got a score for you. Some of it's great. Tarantino stole a piece from this movie for one of his things, and that doesn't make something great, but it makes it notable anyway. Mm. And but it's just, again, like this is all like, just don't call it The Exorcist 2. Just call it The Heretic. I'm fine.
Right. Well, hopefully we'll make beautiful music next week with Exorcist 3. And don't forget, our bonus Halloween episode is going to drop any day. So be on the lookout for that. Our gift to you, our treat, not trick, as we approach Halloween. Tony, thank you so much. Kokomo.
Kokomo.
Kokomo. Please make a supercut of him saying Kokomo to the tune of Kokomo by the Beach Boys, please. I'm just thinking about it.
Oh, that has to happen.
Oh, that has to happen.
Kokomo. Take me to Kokomo.
Kokomo.
We hope you've enjoyed this edition of Rated P for Paranormal. Please rate, review, and share. It really does make a difference. For more information, to participate, and even donate, go to our main page, anchor.fm/ratedparanormal. On social media, we're at Rated Paranormal. All music is by Andrew Galdens Jr. You can find him on Instagram at Kid Riga, or go to therocketscience.bandcamp.com. This podcast was created, written, produced, and edited by Maddie Blake and Anthony Arkin.
The flames, the fires, we must put out the fires that are clearly here.
All I even needed is something like this.
People that made this piece of shit are in this theater.